You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Of course, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is going out on March 15th, 2023. We're at the beginning of Lent, so I'm not going to deal with practical politics directly. But we're going to deal with someone I haven't spoken of him since the Voice of Reason many years ago. And that's Konstantin Leontiev, who died in 1891. He is as close to a Russian Orthodox Nietzschean as you can get. I was asked about him recently. And just going over the basics of his political thought and how it relates, of course, to geopolitics today. You know, geopolitics is as much a philosophical discipline as it is a political and historical one. Before we get started, I'm working on two things: a book on China as a national socialist state, having no relation to the old Maoist idea. There's some people talking about that with North Korea. And a book on globalization, which is actually putting a bunch of essays of mine together, giving a good solid definition of what that means, as the New World Order idea, which is very real, stated by George Bush years ago, has given way to the Great Reset. Please join my Patreon, because I have a book there now that all subscribers can download, and this is going to be an ongoing project, and I, will be publishing bits and pieces on there, and that's going to be expanded as time goes on. Konstantin Leontiev, he was one of the more eccentric traditionalist, conservative in the true throne and altar sense that Russia produced. He never quite fit in with any school of thought. The closest you can get is someone like a Nietzsche, even a Wagner, and importantly, Nikolai Danilevsky. The concept of Pan-Slavism comes from this movement, which is widely misunderstood. And there are certain things in this regard that I disagree personally with Leontiev, but no one can deny his brilliance, including his enemies, including people like Berdyaev. In fact, the very first time I came across Leontiev was in Berdyaev's book on him. Many years ago, I was asked about him, and I hadn't gotten to him yet, and it's certainly worth your time. He, at a certain point in his life, he was in the Foreign Service and was in the ambassador's staff in Constantinople within the Turkish Empire. At a certain point in his life, he had a severe crisis of faith, which the era, he's born in 1831, he dies in 1891, the era of extremes, the era of ideology. Liberal Marxist progressivism on the one hand, the left in general, and the various islands of theory that made up the general right wing. One of the things that makes the right wing what it is this acceptance of hierarchy, both metaphysical and political. So Leontiev at some point retired to Mount Athos, and a lot of his major works were written there. He was also very close to the Optino monastery as well, which most of you know of, which also had a strong royalist political point of view. Leontiev was not a nationalist, at least not in the sense that, I usually define it. I have a very specific definition. He uses what I think is an incorrect definition of nationalism, which only concerns what some of us call the civic entity, the civic nation, which is really the state. Using that word, nation, to refer to two opposing ideas is a very bad way to proceed. For a whole lot of reasons. The state, as independent of an empire or anything else, is a liberal idea. It's meant to level differences. It's meant to serve an urbanizing and industrializing capitalist class. That's its ultimate purpose. It may or may not have any connection with the nation as a ethno-linguistic unity based on a certain faith. And normally, you know, an ethnic group very rarely can be divided religiously. And when it is, it is schizophrenic. You know, this is why in the Second Reich in Germany, Catholics were removed and the old Catholics were promoted, which is why France reacted to the Huguenot lunatics before the revolution. In fact, the Huguenots, who were essentially Judaized, were, you know, very much in sympathy with it. Calvinism is a disease on the world. That was the problem with Protestants among its completely arbitrary theology and ahistorical approach to things. They created such extreme division. The Huguenots in France, in fact, destroyed St. Irenaeus' grave. Little do they know that St. Irenaeus was important in putting the Bible together. So it's a single faith and a single linguistic and cultural idea. I mean, the entire Ukrainian national process in the 17th century was based on their war with the Uniates. Uniates considering themselves, you know, Ukrainian nationalists are a little bizarre, since that entire ideal was formed at war not just with Poland, but with the Vatican's Uniate movement. Now, he uses the civic idea of the nation and rejects it on the grounds that it's leveling based on abstract rights and things like that. And as far as that goes, he's correct. Leontiev is a Byzantinist. And what we're going to do is deal mostly with his philosophy of history. And so for that, we have to start with Nikolai Danilevsky. I've dealt with many, many times, and I've written on many, many times, the idea of the Slavophiles, Slavophilism. Essentially a national and ethnic anarchist movement, still royalist, though. Yet they were opposed to the state, not the crown. They're two very different things. Where the spiritual world of monasticism and orthodoxy was at the core. It was not expansionist. It, even though they weren't all believers, it had to have been ideologically very sympathetic to them. And you see the birth of kind of a vulgar pan-Slavism coming from his work. This is as the 1840s and 1850s start giving way. And Danilevsky is not all that dissimilar to many traditionalist and pessimistic writers in the West. Instead of the German idealistic idea, and it was very popular in Russia at the time, he's claiming to be an empiricist. And the organization of the globe is based on culture and historical types. Cultures leading to civilization. And he, as well as Leontiev, rejected the typical liberal Marxist or anarchist sense of a single linear process going from inferior to superior as time goes on and they gain more power. Russian right wing, and the right wing pretty much everywhere, views history as cyclical. It doesn't mean it's not going in a direction, but it proceeds by fits and starts. Of course, people like Danilevsky go too far, and I don't want to exaggerate this, but when you have a civilizational relativism, you reject the concept of natural law. There are certain things about humans as humans that transcend language. There is a human nature. It may be manifest very differently in different parts of the world, in different times, different topographies, different climates, different levels of industrialization, close to the oceans. But still, there are some very basic things that a human being has to have. You know, education, theology, metaphysics, artistic endeavor, the family, form of authority and hierarchy. These are all built into the very concept of humanity, and therefore, while not using the term rights, they are an aspect of natural law. Now, because that's so broad, civilizations develop very differently, and within those civilizations, ethnicity develops very differently. These are two different levels of analysis. Civilization is far larger and takes it to itself, into itself, related, more or less complementary ethnic groups. And those two things always exist in tension. I mean, it's going on right now. The whole Eurasianist idea is based on this. Now, what the Slavophiles and many of the Germans had argued in the beginning of the 19th century, middle of the 19th century, is that a certain basic idea based on natural law, scriptures, and the Creator, sees nations and civilizations and cities as all contributing some very important aspect of the whole. And that sort of thing, and it's a very moderate conception here, and I have no problem with it at all. Because they do claim, I mean, Christians have to talk about a universal history. Even the Bible deals with it. But again, that's at a level of generalization and requires interpretation that really any philosophy of history can fit into it one way or another. Danilevsky says that the question here isn't so much the mission of Russia as an Orthodox power, but the formation of Russia as a very specific historical type. So the Slavs, you know, the problem with pan-Slavism is they don't seem to take religion seriously. Because of course, Croats and Poles are Slavs of a sort. But even there, they see a cultural historical type, and ecumenism seems to be built into this. And that this cultural type, based on, you know, the Indo-European language, the Slavic languages in the East, can create the foundation of a civilization. And both Leontief and Danilevsky proposed a struggle with what they call the Romano-German world. And of course, he's talking about that modern world. You know, no civilization can be as individualistic and mechanistic as it was to become in the West. It's not an ethnic matter. In fact, with Leontief, he denies that entirely. What they are worried about is the Romano-German invasion of the Russian intellectual space. They see by the 1850s a attempt at imitation. We see this in China and Japan too, almost a servile attitude towards the West. And these things, because they grow in a very specific soil, can't be transferred to another soil without distortion. It's like giving a blood transfusion for the wrong blood type. And Leontief was far superior as a theoretician than Danilevsky, but they had a lot in common. Now, you don't have to go so far as this is civilizational relativism, but you can consider them as self-contained and complete organisms. Now, the decay, the problem, is where the organism becomes a mechanism. But in this approach, Leontief rejects any conception of abstract freedoms and abstract rights. Precisely because they're abstract. They don't attach to any specific way of life. But there is a naturalistic conception here. And there's a very specific process. We'll get to that in a second. But at their best, cultures are living organisms. They do evolve and develop with a host of variables that make it different from everyone else. And of course, we can only talk about generalizations here. The transition is from the primitive simplicity, and then splitting up into originality and complexity, and then a process of decay. And the only way that this could happen, especially in the more healthy building of this, is inequality. Because only an aristocracy, a true aristocracy, can create legitimate diversity within the civilizational type. The most literate and most motivated are absolutely necessary for a culture to develop and to become more and more sophisticated in the sense we'll get to here in a second. And this growing complexity of any civilization, as it becomes more complex, becomes more individualized. It's a very specific self-expression. And, you know, cultural development here, you know, you could talk about literacy rates, you could talk about material indicators, but that's secondary. What he's talking about is political and artistic originality, variations on a theme. So Leontief had a pattern made up of three stages that you can generally apply to civilizations around the planet. And that, so this is something that's beyond a civilizational foundation. This, in fact, unifies them. I mentioned primitive simplicity as the first stage. This is cultural uniformity. You don't have high rates of literacy. You don't have high rates of trade. You have what Marx may even call the most primitive communism, the warrior band. Then that begins to give way to what he calls complex flourishing. That society becomes, without leaving its historical norm and its civilizational norm, becomes more complex as the division of labor develops. And it grows to the point where every aspect of the culture has a distinctive character, but always within the confines of a style. And then a secondary simplification, where due to leveling and vulgarity, an aristocracy becoming an oligarchy, caring only about the material things of the world, seeing law as a weapon rather than a manifestation of themselves, culture becomes civilization. Of course, we live in a civilization because a culture is organic, a civilization is mechanistic. And the aristocracy that created this flourishing culture starts losing its best people, its distinctive style. Mass society, in a very general sense, and there's one thing about the masses, is that they're homogenous. Not even in a good way. They don't share anything. They are very easy to manipulate. They don't have their own identity. The move from the countryside to the city, as so many peasants did, is part of where the mass came from. This is a form of cultural decomposition, which Leontief thought in general was very hard to forestall. And of course, this isn't just for civilizations. He's talking about organism as such. Even our own bodies become more complex, our brains, what we know, and as we grow and become educated, our individuality, within, of course, the ethnic context, starts to develop. But it can't last forever. The very nature of matter is to fall apart into its constitutive pieces. And as you lose your distinctiveness, now in the intellectual world, so long as you keep your brain sharp, you go well into your 90s these days. But retirement, in the normal sense of the term, you start losing that which is distinctive. And it goes back to what he calls the original and initial simplicity. The point of him writing, of course, is that once we know the pattern, we could take measures before decay shows itself to contain the illness, so to speak, the cancer. It can't be completely forestalled, but it can be slowed substantially. Death is unavoidable for all material things. So we're talking about postponement of the end. Now, he's writing in the 1860s. This is an era of tremendous crisis. Russia's under attack. And he sees Russia as the heir to Byzantium. In fact, that's its entire claim to legitimacy is Byzantium, not Kiev. It was Rome. And politically speaking, the illness that affects societies and the transition from culture to mechanism or civilization is the diffusion of liberal and egalitarian ideas. Especially as he's looking at Russia now, that foreign mass ideologies try to find their way into the society. Aristocracy and culture are difficult. It requires a tremendous amount of work and a tremendous amount of independence and the willingness to be as Socrates was, a threat as this genius continues to develop. Mass society and liberalism is easy. There are no standards. It always angered me when liberals who don't really have standards condemn us for not living up to our very difficult ones. It's very easy when you do whatever you please. A simple culture, there's nothing wrong with it. But it doesn't have the technical, the division of labor, the sense of political articulation that will eventually create the culture in its complexity. So there is no such thing as a conservatism in the primitive unity. That would simply be stagnation. But flourishing complexity. The point is the maximum amount of diversity without leaving the basic confines of the civilizational foundation. That would be, you know, orthodoxy, the family, the monarchy. I mean, how many different theories of monarchy are there? All of which end up in the same place. Delaying the inevitable, I mean, it's no different than us. I mean, we want to delay the inevitable, or at least minimize it once it starts to occur. The literature on Leontief is substantial. Andrzej Wielicki, a Polish writer who has written one of the best works on the Slavophile movement I've ever read, stresses the fact that, yes, he is a reactionary, but whoever maintains this natural law idea of the flourishing complexity within a very tightly organized culture is a friend of his. So that would include medieval Western Europe, and we'll see here in a minute, the Turkish Empire, which he really came to love, and he opposed the Bulgarian schism, which is very rare since almost all of Russian Orthodoxy supported it. And because of the specific intellectual history of Russia, Leontief is very, he's distinctive in that he is very anti-democratic. Aristocracy, monarchy, and this metaphysical verticality is extremely important. The Slavophiles, of course, they had a spiritual verticality, but their concern was horizontal. And he never, ever compromised with anything like egalitarianism. But as I mentioned, you know, writers like Basil Zinkowski show how eccentric Leontief is. He has almost a, what would he call, what Zinkowski calls, an amoral aestheticism. That true cultural flourishing can be found in the art, making him very different from the right wing in Russia at the time. And there's a lot of people who mention this, Donald Treadgold and Grigoryev, the great agrarian, see him almost as a what they call a syncretist, able to combine the best aspects of civilization into a workable ideology. And, you know, without violating both its own culture and human nature. People like Mazzotic stress his theocracy. He is a theocrat in a solid sense of that term. And he is idiosyncratic, partially because, as Richard Pipes and so many others say, that he was vehemently anti-bourgeoisie, almost a futurist. He's not secular by any means. But others have called him a heroic vitalist. People like Lukashevich compare him with Nietzsche and Spengler. In fact, you could see much of Spengler in both Danilevsky and Leontief. A problem that many of us have, especially those of us who were Roman Catholic at one point and who came to Orthodoxy later, we recognize, especially when we're confronting Protestants, that the Church of Rome in the High Middle Ages was a very motivated, artistic, and highly intellectual organization. For whatever disagreements we have as a cultural matter, it is admirable. And Leontief agrees that the Church of Rome in the High Middle Ages, even the Renaissance, was extremely important for this creation of a diversified culture, combining the classical age with their own. This is an aristocratic and royalist Europe. He saw that everywhere. In fact, wherever this idea shows itself, regardless of anything else, despite his strict orthodoxy, he admires. He says that Europe reached its peak during the Renaissance, and he's willing to take this really until just before the American Revolution. The 19th century, a very different story. The 19th century saw the rise of anarchism, of Marxism, stuff that came out of the French Revolution, the Commune, Paris Commune. And he said this, and this is, I'm quoting directly, actually from a secondary source. Leontief says that little by little, European civilization is disposing of all that was elegant, picturesque, and poetic to the museums and the pages of books, and introducing to all aspects of life mere prose, physical monstrosity, uniformity, and death. Prose, uniformity, death, egalitarianism, liberalism, mass society, all basically one thing. You have abstraction rather than specificity. The problem with the 19th century was increasing prosperity, materially speaking. That's where you get the oligarchy, that's where you get the invasion of naive, democratic, and liberal ideals, despite serving that oligarchy, serve to reduce that society to a mass media culture, which destroys the aristocracy necessary for any of the masterpieces of classicism, the decay of literature and art into vulgarity, and people just, being instructed rather than educated. And he calls liberal process nothing but a process of disintegration, like a cancer or cholera. I disagree with Leontief on his generally positive estimation of Peter the Great. And I think he's wrong to look at Catherine the Great as a peak of Russia. Certainly as an international power, he would be right. But that came at the expense. I mean, I'm way too much of a Slavophile to accept some of this. But you have to take him seriously. He's looking in very general terms. The joining of a pan-European royalist idea after the defeat of Napoleon can preserve the proper level of cultural sophistication. You only have tyranny. You only have despotism when vulgarity reigns, when mechanism reigns, where the state is just a power rather than an authority. The concept of a highly motivated, educated, independent aristocracy within the national and civilizational tradition, of course, is essential. Attacks on that are something along the lines of a cancer. What the 18th century in Russia introduced turned out to be the seeds of its secondary simplification, which is just its decay. Now, of course, Leontiev never lived to see what happened. But chances are he would have taken the Kerensky government and everything that happened from 1905 to 1918 as part of this decay. So Leontiev is looking in the 1860s. The old myth, of course, is that Russia was defeated in the Crimean War and had to rethink its institutions. Russia did not lose the Crimean War. It lost a couple of very minor things in the resultant treaty, but Europe was completely exhausted militarily. Russia didn't lose the Russo-Japanese War either, and I dealt with that at great length. But the reforms of 1861, Alexander II, that opened the path to liberalism and massification. And this is why Leontiev began writing. And then he adds a monastic orthodoxy to the Third Rome, the Byzantine monastic tradition, and he sees Byzantium as the very foundation of Russian statehood. And whatever it becomes, that's its foundation. Anything that attacks that, and you start seeing this, Pisarev and the nihilists and everything else, this is the invasion of Western vulgarity, Western industrialization onto Russia. And he says, even globally speaking, it's this Greco-Slavic civilization, which is a last hope, not just for Europe, but for mankind. Remember, he saw growing uniformity and vulgarity and laziness and oligarchy and disintegration as certain as our own death. Because Russia has such a tremendous calling, when Russia falls, it's going to be catastrophic. And if she was absolutely right, you imagine what history would be like had the Tsar never fallen. There'd be a billion Russians today. The population was growing so quickly. Leontiev actually predicted that Russia will go from a God-fearing people to a God-fighting people. Now, we all know that Russians weren't directly involved in this. There was an alien force. But that very same alien force, as was well known in Russia at the time, is part of the rise of oligarchy and finance capital and vulgarization and pornography. Socialism is too abstract. But the socialism he's talking about is leftist. It's Marxian. He foresaw materialist, vulgar, mass socialism as Russia's future. This is Antichrist for him. Socialism can be, socialism's been around a long time. It can be idealistic. It can be family-centered. Now, just the Judaized version of it is the problem here. Leontiev even was willing to compromise with certain aspects of socialism that remained Christian and idealistic. Certain brands of socialism were as much at war with liberalism as he was. He saw certain aspects of utopian socialism as containing anti-bourgeois and anti-materialist ideas. Europe was already dying of industrialization and urbanization and secularization and the rise of the state and mass warfare and everything else, and having that exported to Russia was a disaster. In fact, many have remarked that near the end of his life, he began reading socialist literature, as I have. Materialism is the problem, but there can be an aristocratic, and well, Christian socialism has been around a very long time. Not to mention the fact, very powerful personalities can be forged during periods of chaos and warfare. Socialism for him was probably going to be the nihilist, the nihilistic revolution. But it didn't have to be. Keeping bourgeoisie and therefore capitalism at bay is one of the ways that the monarchy could preserve itself. And this is no joke, since that's exactly what Alexander III and Nicholas II did with the labor legislation and, you know, the increasing prosperity without oligarchy. And, of course, that oligarchy was going to take over in at the end of World War I. And it's not just, you know, the Leontievs of the world. Alexander Herzen, the famed liberal financed by London banks, once he went into exile, financed by the Rothschild family, and he even mentions it himself, he doesn't last long. His liberalism goes out the window the minute he gets a day-to-day taste of what London's bourgeoisie is, or was. And he will reject that form of liberalism as Herzen went on. The left still tries to claim him. But he saw what industrialization and capitalism was up close. So you have the arch-liberal and the royalist coming together at roughly the same time. 1847, he emigrated away from Russia and just saw the bourgeoisie as just Philistine. Then he said, and this was a very common argument, that the liberals of Russia, the so-called reformists, have a very distorted view of what Europe is. They see it as this land of plenty, not realizing what the factories really are like. It's an ideal conception of Europe, not the real conception of Europe. It's from books and literature rather than actual experience. They were there and they saw what Western civilization was, especially in the cities, what it had become. And the only thing that, even Kormyakov, as great as he was, he saw the best of the Anglo-Saxons, the aristocracy, the, you know, the landed agrarians, you know, the Gothic even, not the day-to-day life of the mass. Leontiev spent a lot of time reducing all of this, not just to an ideology, but to a group of people. Herzen, I'm going to quote Herzen here, that the difference between the ideal Europe and the real one, he says, the valor of chivalry, the elegance of aristocratic manners, the stern decorum of the Protestants, the proud independence of the English, the luxurious life of Italian artists, the sparkling wit of the encyclopedias, the gloomy energy of the terrorists, all of this has been melted down and transmuted into one integral combination of different predominant manners, the bourgeoisie, with its morality of a lower order. He saw liberalism as an aristocratic idea, not a mass one. We talked about democracy, we're talking about a mass society. And the prototype there was what both Herzen and Leontiev called the colorless intermediate figure. That is to say, intermediate meaning the middle class. The total opposite of the medieval ruler, the medieval knight, the medieval crusader. The morality of the middle classes, the bourgeoisie, was based around the rise of both manufacturing and finance capital. It had strong Judaic and Protestant foundations. And the only social obligation it ever understood was increasing wealth and reputation by fair means or foul. And of course, this is to be found, the wealthier and the more industrialized, the more developed Western economies were, the more this bourgeois idea was present. So people like, they were both European travelers. Italy and Spain were far preferable to places like Antwerp or London. Finally, you know, even liberals like Herzen were turning on what the West had become, and we're still living in it. We're not that far away from World War I here. Neither one of them lived to see that. But that was the apogee World War I and World War II, of what, 60, 70 million people. He saw European culture as directed towards monotony, not autonomy, and not class rule. The European bourgeoisie are not just decaying, but they are in fact decay. They're the bacteria that destroy civilization. The, you know, all processes of decay in material things, living things, or organic things, is a bacterial movement. That bacteria for society is liberalism, in a very general sense, democratic ideas, egalitarianism. And he, along with many others, attacked the idea of linear progress. And, you know, he's talking about urban areas, he's talking about the capitalist elite and the growing colonial empires who use Darwinism and development as their justifying principle. And Leontief sees this as a pathology. The bourgeoisie is both a symptom and a cause of decay. He sees the bourgeoisie as self-satisfied. They're living off a moral inheritance that they are not only not contributing to, but are destroying. And when that inheritance is exhausted, you have postmodern America. He sees places like, and he mentions Denmark, Holland, Switzerland. Yes, they're peaceful. Yes, they're materially prosperous, but they're also boring. The eight-hour day, the removal from the land, money takes the place of actual created goods. A flourishing culture requires an aristocracy. And he makes the connection between democratic and liberal ideas on the one hand and its relationship to art on the other. And so that's really the most obvious thing. You know, the sitcom, for example, today, reality TV, that's the final perversion, the stink of a rotting corpse. Leontief says everyday life should be poetic. It should be varied within its national unity and insulated from the West. And what he means by that, of course, is liberalism. Democracy and vulgarity are one and the same thing. In the early years of a democratic government, the old aristocratic ways are still present. They're not institutionalized anymore, but they're still present. Over time, even that starts to decay. The greatest sin is for society to be prosaic, to be based only on efficiency. And, you know, will that earn you any money? A bigger house is better than a smaller one. Beauty is at stake. This is what the bourgeoisie provide. It's the destruction of beauty. The Judaic approach to art. Nature itself reveals itself in diversity, in variety, without, of course, leaving its own laws and all of its variables that make organic things organic. The natural order, as the German idealist, especially Schelling, has said decades earlier, should be the model. Poetry is one of the main expressions of this flowering. And the bourgeoisie has no way of even reading it. The symbolism that you need to interpret in poetry requires a huge store of literary knowledge. But that doesn't earn you money. That doesn't build factories. That doesn't create colonies. The more the middle class develops, the less the national order, not the natural, the national order will grow. Capitalism and liberalism, they are inherently imperialist. They are inherently globalized. Mechanization, industrialization require new markets and new inputs And that's really where the modern conception of colonialism came from. Natural resources. Africa, Asia, they're loaded with them. That's the foundation of imperialism. For Britain and the Netherlands, imperialism was commercial. For Russia, it was purely defensive and never beyond its own borders. The ultimate threat is uniformity. The mass society we're forced to live in today that these men couldn't even have conceived. This mass society has nothing to inspire. The poet will have nothing to write about, as he would say. And he says the sculptor will then only decorate railway stations and or mold columns for gas lamps. Little did he know what was going to happen to architecture in the next generation or so. The church was extremely important there. And at least in that sense, he put the Roman church in the Middle Ages and the Russian church in his own day on the same level. Not as theology is concerned, but as a defender of aristocratic poetic society. Financial prosperity and peace are destructive. This monotony, this boredom, it levels not just people, but their thought process. And you know, I started off by saying that he was anti-nationalist, and I do want to modify that here a little bit. The Slavophile laid out the theoretical basis for what Russian nationalism is. It was a cultural, it was a religious, in other words, it was an ethnic idea. The concept of integralism. The peasant commune. Subordinos, not collectivism, but community. This is what's going to lead not just Russia, but all of humanity from liberal individualism to its true end in natural law and civilization. Nationalism need not concern itself too much with the state and with, you know, fundamental institutions that apply to everybody. The fact that we can go in front of a jury and those are our peers, these idiots who weren't smart enough to get out of jury duty, they are not our peers. Of course, in aristocracy, only aristocrats are our peers. For the Slavophile, I'm not thinking, they're related, certainly. The aim was a fraternal unity of Orthodox strugglers in a unified environment, but of course taking ethnicity very seriously, as it does, and that the Russian nation was going to bring this about. Pan-Slavism is more crude. Maybe 25 years after the Slavophiles wrote, and it differs largely in its politics. The Third Rome wanes and sometimes waxes in importance. The Third Rome sometimes was interpreted as a civilizing mission, as a missionary idea. And it received new popularity due to the so-called Eastern question, Russian aspirations in assisting the Balkan Slavs and the Greeks against the Turks. It should be noted that Leontiev opposed the anti-colonial movements of the Serbs and Bulgarians, making him fairly unpopular. This is why I say that he really wasn't a part of any school. And because of Leontiev, Pan-Slavism lost a lot of its appeal. And the book I've already mentioned, Danilevsky, the book I should say is Russia in Europe. That's the concept of this cyclical progress. Different and differing due to the ethnic and historical type of the civilization that we're dealing with. And like most of the Russian right at the time, there's not much of any kind of compatibility between the East Slavs, at least, and the liberal West. This kind of liberalism, and they underestimated how militant it could be, can't create the differential. Can't differentiate the discipline. Can't create the discipline necessary for strong armies. Of course, World War One will show that they'll rely on technology and start counting bodies in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. Now, none of this is aggressive. This is, whether it be nationalism or Pan-Slavism, you know, Pan-Slavism has a lot of incoherencies. What makes Leontief different is his pessimism. The Russian nation has a mission, but only within its own culture. But beyond culture, it's the attack on liberal individualism. You know, I've said before, you know, the Russian nation survived everything from famines and Stalin and the German invasion and the 18th century, war after war after war after war, taking on all of Europe and Crimea. And they survived, and they were stronger as a result. The one thing that Russia almost didn't survive was liberalism, was liberal capitalism, the rule of capital. He sees Europe in this point of decline, that third stage. Central unity, the central cultural unity is starting to weaken. And the more it weakens, the more it falls apart, the more confusion, the more chaos is introduced. Art, aestheticism was the core of Leontief's idea. Beauty, splendor, that's the core of his viewpoint. He has to despise the commonplace, the prosaic, as we've already hinted, the banal. The struggle, Baroque struggle, and its architecture and music was extremely important for him. His religion was a militant one. It is based on these civilizing entities, which God has specifically chosen to spread his message. It was very stern. It was very Old Testament inspired. But he was a student of monasticism without question. There's a quote here. Let me quote him from him in this era of his life. He says, "Charity, goodness, justice, self-denial. All these qualities can manifest themselves only when there is sorrow, inequality, wrong, and cruelty. One cannot take only the sweet, tender, and pleasant, the comforting elements, and leave out the monstrous, severe, and torturing ones. It is stupid to believe in the reign of truth, in happiness for mankind." Now, what he seems to be saying here is that the fall of Adam continues to snowball. The old innocence of Adam and Eve and that a lack of civilization, that innocence remained for a long time. But as more and more sin piled on to the early communities, the more vice is ignored, the difference between God and matter is confused, the worse things are going to get. And part of the discipline, what he found worthwhile in monasticism, was the self-discipline and the asceticism to actually contribute to this flowering of beauty. Unfortunately, his solution seemed to be fairly ham-handed. The strong state. The Slavophiles relied on the horizontal communal element. But very much like the fascists a little later and the integralists, in a time of crisis, the state has to organize itself in formal terms. Power was just as important as authority, especially in his era, and is going to be the case in a good chunk of the 20th century, too. The gentle professions of urban Netherlands and Britain can't make war with the very mass society that animates them. Liberal and egalitarian, these are manifestations, and in fact are the very process of decay. true artistic progress was going to be destroyed by mass society, the reign of quantity. He says, all true artists, poets, those gifted with a strong aesthetic sense, have little love for the average in their heart. They love nobility, high society, heroic military deeds. Byron fled the civilized countries in order to live among the wild and forsaken gardens of Italy and Spain. Now, Leontief did not reject the reforms of Alexander II. But he did condemn the idea of trial by jury, too. They taught the people that this a little group of very average people can reach truth. He saw all of this as the seeds of liberalism, claiming that any random jury of people who are breathing is therefore my peer, represents my peers, was too much for him to handle. True art can't thrive in that decay, in that so-called, ethnic, racial, ideological diversity that accepts everything except inequality. As I've mentioned, socialism in many of its forms was preferable to liberalism since it was militant and well-organized. You have a lot of this left in those who still see the Soviet Union as a positive thing at a minimum in that it kept the bourgeois mentality at bay. I mean, that could be exaggerated, but the roots of that idea can be found here. The tradition for Leontief lies in the Middle Ages, especially when he's talking about Western Europe. It's modernity and nominalism and liberalism that destroys beauty, that destroys religion. Equality means that there's no reason to believe X over Y. And then what happens to you? If there's no way to know absolute truth, if absolute truth is just a metaphor, then why study anything at all? If my opinion is as good as yours, then why bother? I could just say whatever I want. Now, Russia's role is based not specifically on the genetic predisposition of being Russian, but it's cultural. It comes from Russia's position as the heir of Byzantium in its political tradition and its support of the Orthodox faith. Despite the development of the Pan-Slavic movement, Leontief didn't really have any faith in other Slavic nations. When he saw the rebellions in the Balkans, he saw these states as being invaded by Western money, and he wasn't wrong. It would bring leveling and uniformity to these countries. He refused to turn on the Turkish Empire that he was, an ambassador to for some time, or at least on the staff. He refused to support the Slavic cause and supported the Turks and the Fanar Greeks. Not necessarily any specific policy, but for him, the Turks were a medieval, hierarchical a throwback to the ancient and medieval Middle East. And this is why I started this off by saying I can't possibly agree with everything. He did prefer the Turks to the Slavs because at least the Turks were a proven entity. They were falling behind, although that can be exaggerated in terms of modernity, and maybe it was its undoing. And not only the Ottomans, but the Habsburgs as well. He didn't see a native royalist tradition in the Balkans, among the Balkan Slavs. The concept of a constitutional government, and you're going to see this occurring in Greece, for example, it will destroy any possibility of the rebirth of Byzantium in its Greek environment. National autonomy. We're not talking about cultural autonomy. National autonomy was a democratic principle. This is why some people will say that the French Revolution gave birth to nationalism. That is a simplistic and extremely ignorant statement. Only if you redefine what the national is to refer to mass society, the state, welfare programs, imperialism, serving the bourgeoisie, then, of course, you might be right. But nationalism can't be opposed to itself. Let me end here with one more quote from him. And this is actually very programmatic, and it summarizes everything we're doing here. Universal democracy and political nationalism are but two aspects of the same thing. The idea of nationality is founded upon race, as manifest in the 19th century, is a purely liberal, anti-political, and anti-religious one. It has great destructive potential, but very little to offer in return, constructive. There is no cultural criterion, for culture implies diversity. Where nationalism was less inspired by nationalist ideas, in the popular sense, than by monarchy, then it incarnated itself unconsciously. Whole nations and individual men displayed the most varied characteristics and flourished upon them. Now that nationalism seeks to emancipate itself, to become composite, to group men together less in the name of distinct interests such as religion, monarchy, and privilege, than in the name of equality, freedom, and race for its own sake. Now an essentially identical result is achieved in brief democracy. All nations and all men begin to look alike, more and more so. Thus their spiritual misery grows ever more acute. The flowering of culture is brought about by transcendental principles. And the objective value of ideas, in itself, the principle of nationality, has but one content. It is essentially democratic and hence capable only of deflowering. The national principle, stripped as it is today of its specific religious forms and presented in its purely racial aspect, is a falsehood. Ethnic policy is one of the strangest illusions of the 19th century. In a strict sense of the word, there is nothing national in the racial principle. Now, I quoted that at length for a few reasons. You notice that he goes back and forth there. Just like I've been saying for years, there are two opposed conceptions of what the nation is, whether it be the formal institutions of the state or the culture which it's supposed to protect. With the rise of capitalism and industrialization, he sees the latter growing weaker while the former grows stronger. The state doesn't necessarily just refer to the formal institutions of power, the agencies, the police agency, Social Security, whatever. It can also mean, especially in German, the cultural foundations of a people. He's saying that with the rise of industrialization, the formal institutions will dominate the qualitative institution, the culture, the family, the nation. Back in the 19th century, the word race was synonymous with ethnicity, not necessarily, you know, white people, black people. Race and ethnicity were more or less synonymous. What I think he's saying, this is where we're going to end, what he's saying is if ethnicity by itself is taken as an abstraction, in other words, we're all equal because we're all Serbs, which is absurd. I don't know anyone who says that. But if that's what it comes down to, especially given the economic context, then it's a bad thing. But of course, there's nothing wrong with that. Ethnicity needs to be elevated. And of course, the church, the aristocracy, natural law does all of that. He sees this, he sees it in the Balkans, he certainly sees it in Greece, a foreign educated stratum of liberal politicians, often financed by the British, are taking over. This is what he's talking about here. This is why he accepts the Ottomans over this. Ultimately, this is all British inspired. The destruction of ethnicity. And of course, there's a Judaic element here as well. He's basically saying that the state destroys ethnicity. Of course, a civilization can be found in ethnicity, but only under very certain circumstances. He's looking at the Balkans, say in the 1860s, and he sees, as the Russians have defeated the Turks all over the place, he sees a Western-educated, Western-financed group of exiles from abroad, who've been living abroad for a very long time, come back and take over. They have no right to do that, But they have the money, they have the experience, they have the mystique of living in the West. This is particularly pronounced in Serbia and Greece. That's what he's looking at, using the principle of nationality to gain power at the expense of the Turks. They're not Orthodox people. They're not traditionalists. That's what he's looking at. Well, as always, I only got to about half of what I wanted to talk about. But we may continue this the next time. I'm not sure. But in the meantime, I thank all of you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.